This is the first part of the question and answer period that happened between the members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and former President of the United States, Al Gore, on January 28, 2009.
Well, Mr. Vice President, that's dramatic and, frankly, remarkable testimony. And I'm going to order the full printing, if we can, of this testimony. And indeed of the following questions, and I'm going to distribute it to every single one of our members in the Senate. And we'll find some way, if possible, maybe you could cooperate with us. I know you can't get the motion in the slides, but if we could get some of those accompanying slides as a separate entry, then we'd be able to accompany those. I think Bob Correll is nodding. We can try and get some of those from him. But that'd be really helpful. If ever there was a underscoring of the urgency, I think you've given it to us in a very important, significant way, and this is a significant hearing for that reason. Let me ask you if I can one of the things that just struck me as you were talking about the methane being released and the instant doubling is the fact that many people are not aware of that CO2 in the atmosphere has a half-life of something like 80 to 100 years, if I'm correct.
I think the scientists will say that 100 years from now, 50% of it will fall out of the atmosphere. However, 1,000 years from now, 20% of what we put up this year will still be there. So it's as one would expect, a more complex picture. But basically, if we can get half of it out over 100 years, that's a hopeful sign. If a lot of it remains after 1,000 years, it's a sobering warning that the quicker we reduce, the better.
But that which is already up there continues, absent it being somehow extracted, it continues to do the damage it's doing now.
Yes, yes.
Which means that if your temperature has already increased something like 0.8 degrees centigrade, with the amounts that we're adding to what's already up there and the span of time we're now looking at for reductions, we will automatically see, without anything else interfering, an increase in temperature up to about 1.6, 1.7 degrees centigrade.
Roughly 0.7, 0.8 degrees centigrade has already occurred. Another 0.7, 0.8 is already stored in the oceans and will be re-released. But the continuing potential for the CO2 that remains in the atmosphere, as you pointed out, will continue to produce further increases. Yes.
Therefore, our cushion between the tipping point that scientists have warned us of, the 2 degrees centigrade, and as you said, we have to achieve 350 parts per million is the goal that most scientists now believe will result in stability. Is that correct?
That is the goal that I support, and that is my reading what I believe is the best science. I think that an accurate picture of the science is that leading researchers like Professor Jim Hansen, like Dr. Jim Hansen at NASA, have now begun to coalesce around the very strong feeling that 350 is the appropriate goal. After years of debate within an international political framework, other scientists have despaired about the ability of the political system to do what the science mandates and have coalesced around 450, some even 550. But the more the evidence comes in, the more it becomes increasingly apparent that 350 is the appropriate goal. If we're at 386 now and the entire North Polar ice cap is completely melting in 5 years and both Greenland and West Antarctica are now clearly at risk, obviously we need to be below the level that we're at now.
Right. Now, to get there, this is sort of the key question, which we still have naysayers here, though I think there are less of them than there used to be. But obviously the politics of getting through this are complicated, as we all understand. I know you've been giving a lot of thought to this. You've had a lot of meetings, one of them recently up at Harvard. Share with us, if you would, What do you say to somebody from the coal state? There was an article in the New York Times yesterday about a sort of group within the caucus, even in the Democratic Party, who are reluctant to move rapidly because they have a coal industry or interests in their states, and they think they're going to lose competitiveness or lose jobs. What's your what's the direct answer to them about the options here and the opportunities here?
Well, I think it's quite responsible to support robust research into whether or not it might in the future become possible to safely capture and sequester CO2 from coal plants. But we should not delude ourselves about the likelihood that that's going to occur in the near term or even the midterm. It is extremely expensive. There is not a single large-scale demonstration plant anywhere in the United States. The one plant was canceled by the Bush-Cheney administration. And the research is one thing, but we must avoid becoming vulnerable to the illusion that this is near at hand. It is not. And as a result, I believe that we must not have any more conventional dirty coal plants that that do not capture and sequester CO2. I proposed, as a member of this body many years ago, a full employment alternative for any coal miners and workers in the coal industry that are displaced by the need to protect the environment of this planet. Just to keep on doing this incredible damage and harm in the name of their jobs, when we can much more effectively create even better jobs for them, that I believe must be the response, even as we aggressively research the possibility that it might be possible to capture and sequester carbon.
Well, that's a very direct and honest answer, and I appreciate it. Help us to paint the picture a little bit of where you see, I mean, you're currently doing a lot of work with technologies and looking at the sort of energy sector transformation. Share with us, if you would, sort of the immediate vision that you see in this transformative process as we move to this new economy and new base of power.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the energy information...
Let me just share with you the reason you know this full well, but I say this. We have a vote going on, which is why members are getting up and moving out. They're coming back. We'll sort of try to rotate through and keep the hearing going.
Thanks. Well, thank you very much. Indeed, I am familiar with this. The Energy Information Administration, in its report from 2007 on the electric power industry, reported that for the first time, renewable energy sources represented by far the largest new increment of electricity generation in the United States of America. We are beginning to see this shift take place already. Wind power is now mature and fully competitive. It can accelerate its role with the appropriate tax credits and grants to make them usable. And a technology called concentrating solar thermal is now becoming very competitive. Many plants are under construction in the Southwest. And this, of course, uses mirrors to concentrate the solar energy to boil water, just as a nuclear plant or a coal-fired plant does, to drive steam turbines and generate electricity. Scientific American pointed out that if we took an area of the southwestern desert 100 miles on a side, that would be enough in and of itself to provide 100% of all the electricity needs for the United States of America in a full year. And interestingly, this technology matches the peak load exactly throughout the day to the peak load use. So concentrating solar thermal is a very important new source along with wind. And most scientists and engineers expect that the new advances in photovoltaic energy, of course, the kind that directly translate photons into an electrical current, will intersect with concentrating solar thermal midway through this decade. Widely distributed uses of photovoltaics and small wind will also play an increasing role. In all of this, efficiency and conservation must be the number one priority. It gives us the quickest and most cost-effective new sources of energy. Indeed, a lot of it is not only cheap, it actually makes money. And giving the right incentives to use these approaches is very important. I would mention one final source, which is geothermal energy. There are new approaches that fracture the deeper parts of the shelf and create the new sources of geothermal energy. This has great potential. It is not very far off.
I sometimes hear people say, oh, gosh, those are terrific things, when I'm trying to describe some of the things you have, and they'll say, well, yeah, but you can't meet the demand fast enough. Those technologies aren't adequately developed yet, or they're not really cost competitive. In each case, you've articulated today that's not true. You can meet it that fast. They are, in fact, competitive, and they're here now.
I chair the Alliance for Climate Protection, and we conducted extensive work with energy modelers and policy experts to prove this case, that if we set our minds to it, we could in this country produce 100% of our electricity from renewable and carbon-free sources within 10 years. That is possible if we set our minds to it. It requires the construction of a national unified smart grid, which gives us two new tools, the ability to transfer large amounts of renewable electricity from the solar areas of the Southwest to the cities where it's used, from the wind corridor in the mountain states east and west to the cities where it's used, and from the geothermal areas. It would require a decision to move aggressively to give the incentives to quickly build the new concentrating solar, thermal, and wind facilities that are ready to go right now.
Can you describe those incentives and what amount of money you think ought to be put on the table to support them?
Well, first of all, I think, and I say this to members of the Senate particularly, the conditionality on the pending block grants to states for efficiency represents one of the single most important measures that can be taken. I know those sound like buzzwords and terms of art. Basically, what it applies to is decoupling the current set of incentives that utilities have to just build more dirty coal plants and instead give them a way to make money from not only building new coal plants, but from driving conservation and efficiency and renewable sources. California, on its own initiative, passed a measure like this that has already resulted in an explosion of new construction for renewable electricity sources in California and for a sharp decrease in the use of energy per unit of economic output. So the California system is what should be included in the stimulus bill, and the House of Representatives has already put it in there. It will be decided in conference if it's not changed on the floor when the Senate bill is considered. The second provision that I would highlight is the renewable tax credits that have to be coupled with what the administration has proposed, small grants to make those tax credits economically usable in an environment in which some of those that would use them don't have any profits and taxes to pay, so they have to be able to, in some way, shape, or form, transfer them, get them refunded in ways that give them market value and provide an immediate incentive to start construction.
Mm-hmm. In terms of, in effect, California, which has seen its economy grow, I forget what the percentage is, has actually seen its energy use per capita go down.
Correct.
Even as the population has grown. I mean, that is the perfect model, in a sense.
And it's a result of the policy changes that they made that have helped California's economy. We could get tremendous job creation and other benefits if we adopt this nationwide.
Mm-hmm. Is there any way to capture the methane, these significant pockets, as they become exposed?
In the Arctic? I don't know. I have not heard of any proposal to do that. I'm sure there's research, but it covers such a broad area, it would not seem to be feasible, but if, you know, scientists come up with new ideas all the time, I have not heard any way of doing that.
Mr. Vice President, share with us also, perhaps addressing some of the concerns of senators here and House members, about the local economic competitive dislocation and or cost of doing some of this. The quick hit you hear repeatedly right now because of the economic downturn is, how are we going to afford to do this? Do you want to speak to that?
Well, it may be a classic turn of phrase, but I think the better question is, how can we afford not to do this? Not only because it's a question of urgency for civilization, but also because making this transition is one of the best and most effective ways to create good, new, sustainable jobs quickly. There is a tremendous growth in these new renewable industries. And the world is beginning to shift dramatically in this direction. If the United States once again takes its customary role as the leader of this new trend, then we will create the most jobs and gain the most economic benefit.
Speak to me for a minute, if you will, or to all of us, about Copenhagen. You were in Kyoto. You helped lead that effort and indeed signed that agreement. What is the key to, in your judgment, making Copenhagen a success beyond, you've articulated that we need to pass a cap and trade. But can you give us a sense of what your thoughts are about the shape of Copenhagen and how to get there?
Yes. I think for our country, the road to Copenhagen is to pass the green stimulus measures now pending, pass the cap and trade legislation this year, and those two measures combined will give us not only the moral authority to lead, but also give us the ability to prospectively book impressive CO2 reductions in the years ahead that will make it far easier to meet the goals that will be negotiated in the Copenhagen Treaty. In the treaty itself, I think we have to have strong targets and timetables and binding commitments from in industrial and developing countries. The developing countries, of course, will have differentiated but still binding commitments, and I think the single goal should be CO2 reduction. Second element is the inclusion of deforestation, and as you know, Mr. Chairman, in the conference in Bali a year ago, December, there was a successful result in arriving at a formula that does allow the inclusion of avoided deforestation. Again, 20% of global emissions each year come from deforestation. Third,
can I interrupt for a minute?
Sure.
I've just been informed I only have 2 minutes to get over there on the boat. Senator Shaheen is going to benefit enormously by the cycle here. Senator Lugar is back. You had a moment there. I apologize.
Congratulations, Chairman Shaheen.
Did you see the excitement on her face? Senator Lugar, thank you. And then Senator Shaheen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Shaheen. Mr. Vice President, in my opening statement, I had a narrow part of the picture, admittedly, but you acknowledged my farming situation, and I am interested in this. Norman Borlaug testified for many years before the Agriculture Committee, occasionally this committee, on the Green Revolution. He was not alone in this respect, but he and many others, including Bill and Melinda Gates and their work in Africa, have really had obstacles. They've not struck out, but nevertheless, the situation you presented has already led to difficulties with regard to soil and water conditions and difficulties for people in Africa to produce. Now, if, as Bob Parlberg has pointed out in his book, this is reinforced by prejudices against genetically modified organisms and biotechnology and agriculture, this is a total disaster already and headed toward worse on the data that you have shown. This is why my plea is that let's become a part of the agenda of the picture. Our staff members at the conference that you had just attended struck out again in working with this. And I appreciate within the green or environmental community, there are differences on these issues. I spent some time with European community people in Brussels, and they have differences, although some are now moving in the direction, at least that I would advocate. But do you have any further comment on this that would be helpful today as to how this might become a part of this important agenda and some recognition as a practical matter that people in Africa need to be fed now, quite apart from catastrophes of 5 or 10 years from now?
Yeah. Well, Senator Lugar, thank you for your thoughtful comments. Before addressing specifically genetically modified organisms, I'd like to enthusiastically agree with your overall point that the impact on agriculture in developing countries is going to be quite harsh. If I could briefly illustrate this with a couple of slides, this is from the United Nations Environment Program, and it's just an illustrative example. This shows the nation of Uganda, and the green areas show the areas that are suitable for coffee growing, and the yellow shows less suitable but still suitable areas. A 2-degree increase in temperature does this to the areas for coffee growing. Mm-hmm. So the effort to combat global poverty and to feed those who are hungry is harshly impacted by the impact of global warming, and we have to figure out a way to respond. Developing responses to climate change in the developing world can help reduce this poverty because renewable energy is the best way to bring electricity to the places that don't have it. The emissions trading system does help them economically, and reforestation programs can support rural livelihoods. And many in this chamber and elsewhere, I'm not proselytizing, this was a slide in this deck that is out of my own faith tradition. But experience suggests that the best way to do this is to integrate it into the planning. Now, on genetically modified organisms, the treaty is not a commercial mechanism. It actually remains up to individual nation states to decide on their own if they want genetically modified crops. I do believe the treaty, as you have said, should have funds for adaptation for Africa and poor countries in other regions, and that should include money for help in agriculture. My own view of the scientific controversy on GMOs is that most GMOs turn out to be no different in their impact on the environment than the long, slow process of seed selection that occurred during the Stone Ages and produced today's main food crops. However, Mr. Chairman, we have had several, I would say too many, examples. A small fraction among the many GMO crops, but we have had some that turn out to have had some unanticipated dangerous consequences. I myself have not yet seen an adequately sensitive and reliable screening mechanism to make sure that we catch those few that actually do cause problems. But where we find ones that have been cleared with long experience, then I myself am not opposed to their use.
Well, I thank you for that testimony. I would just say from the practical use on my own farm through now 3 generations, the yields we've been able to obtain, which have been a part of my lifetime, are dramatic. And we would say with regard to our own soil, trees, and the environment, that we've used GMO very satisfactorily. I think this is possible, but the point you're making about certain elements being screened is clearly important. On the farm situation, likewise, the need for building support in the public is obvious. The Pew Foundation's recent report that's often cited listed global warming or climate change as number 20 out of 20 issues that were important to the public now. There may be other months in which the poll does better, not in an economic crisis. But I'm impressed with the fact that the Chicago Climate Exchange, and maybe as a prelude to some type of cap and trade or carbon pricing system in our country, has at least established a price for carbon.
Yes.
Our farmers have become a member of the exchange. We are a potential seller of carbon. It is sequestered in our hardwood trees, which have been measured as we planted them. So this is a new situation. And we get a reading on a website every day. Carbon is now $2.05 in Chicago as of yesterday. This is a very small beginning, but it's an important one. And people from that exchange have been very active in the European markets. I mention all of this because we'll have debates about it again, and we get back to the fact, does anybody really understand how to price, how the exchange occurs, who the suppliers are? Are these valid suppliers? The carbon in my hardwood trees, really, carbon is sequestered. Well, I think that it is. But we can think about no-till planting, likewise, in this respect. The National Farmers Union came together for a press conference in which I participated last year. And they were interested in the sequestering of carbon in the soil and how not to disturb it. How can we go about doing this? But to the extent that this becomes an income source,
right,
for farmers, in addition to a scientific experiment, then a whole difference in American public opinion, at least with one large community, occurs in practical ways. And I cite this because you've worked with public opinion for years. These situations are not easy sells.
Right.
But to the extent there are practical measures with even portions of our population, there may be the kind of support, which leads to my sort of overall question. Kyoto did not do well on the Senate floor when it came. And if we have a treaty this year, and I hope that we will, this one needs to do better. How will we come about in a bipartisan stance, comprehensive with the support of the country, to get either 60 or 67 votes or whatever is required at that point? Can you give any thought to that, just as a practical politician, as well as one who has made a presentation today, which is exemplary?
Well, thank you, Senator Lugar. I am a recovering politician. I'm on about step 9. I'd like to first of all address your comments, if I may, on soil carbon, because I think it's an important question that should be addressed. As a rule of thumb, the amount of carbon now sequestered in trees and forests around the world is roughly equal to twice the amount that is in the atmosphere. The amount of carbon sequestered in soils around the world is up to 4 times as much as the amount in trees. I grew up during the summers on a farm in Tennessee and learned from my dad how to recognize the dark, black, rich soil in the bottomlands. And not until recently did somebody clue me in that what makes that rich soil black is the carbon. And there's 8 times as much carbon in the soils as in the atmosphere, though the flux in and out is much lower than from trees. However, that flux out can increase dramatically from the thawing of those frozen soils, and the flux in the other direction, more rapid sequestration of carbon in the soils, can also be increased. Not necessarily with no-till, although I see that as an improvement, but with new techniques that help farmers increase yields and rapidly sequester carbon in soils. They do not yet have the mechanisms to adequately monitor and measure soil carbon sequestration, though they are close to developing them. The two areas of the world that have most wanted soil carbon included in the treaty are U.S. farmers and the continent of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a coalition. And if the monitoring can be established, then I think it's a very useful measure to begin that addition to the process in Copenhagen so that it can be included. Now, on the prospects for the treaty as compared to Kyoto, the general expectation and acceptance in the developing world that they will have binding commitments in the first phase makes this a very different kind of outlook than was the case with Kyoto. the very fact that developing countries like Brazil and Indonesia, China, which is in its own category, have now begun to take initiatives, I think that makes it a very different situation. And, of course, the strength of the scientific consensus worldwide is now far beyond what it was 10 years ago. The scientists are practically screaming from the rooftops. This is, properly understood, a planetary emergency. Mm-hmm. It is out of the boundaries of scale that we're used to dealing with. And one of my personal challenges for the last 30 years has been to understand how to talk about it in a way that breaks through that denial and resistance. And though some progress has been made, more work needs to be done. I think that President Obama's leadership, which has already been manifested in his statement just 2 days ago, can itself be an important new element in firming support for what needs to be done.
Thank you very much.
I think I'm acting chairman, so I'll recognize myself here. First of all, let me join Mr. Vice President and thank you for your 30 years of effort in this regard. You were a lonely voice, as I recall, in the House of Representatives some 30 years ago talking about this. And occasionally history provides leadership like that. Not often enough, in my view, but I thank you for that.
Thank you.
And I'd be remiss if I didn't also thank the chairman, Senator Kerry, who's also worked very hard on this issue. And did a great job yesterday, in fact, in our caucus lunch, gave a very eloquent exposition about what we needed to be doing in this coming Congress and preparation of Copenhagen. Senator Boxer has been terrific on this issue as well. Jeff Bingaman, my colleague from Connecticut, Joe Lieberman, others have been stalwarts in the efforts to try and make this issue more prominent. I have just two or three quick questions. One you just alluded to that I think is so important. I think the public perception too often on this debate has been that if we in fact go this route, that our lifestyles, that our economic growth and opportunity are going to be severely hampered. You're making a choice in a sense. We're going to have to maybe the political equivalency or the economic equivalency of wearing a hair shirt if we give up this economic path or dependence on fossil fuels that we've been on for so long. Changing that mentality, convincing the public at large, both here and elsewhere, that in fact quite the opposite is the case. That's number one. Number two, I appreciate your emphasis on Brazil and talking about Brazil. And obviously they've done some remarkable things. I was noting that about 50% of our importation of fossil fuels comes from the Western Hemisphere, from Venezuela, Mexico, Canada, that about 80% of the renewable energy resources coming out of Brazil with the use of ethanol coming out of sugarcane. But it poses some issues as well in that the deforestation efforts, the Amazon basin being that drain that you've talked about, is at risk if, in fact, we find an expansion of sugarcane to develop more ethanol for foreign markets, which we encourage to some degree, but obviously there are ancillary and related issues associated with that. And I'd like to hear your comment on that, although I was encouraged by a comment you made that Brazil seems to be entering into a stricter regime when it comes to deforestation programs. And then thirdly is the approach. Obviously, Copenhagen's coming up. We've had the meetings in Bali and other venues, the UN sponsored. What are your thoughts about more regional approaches to this, tying in the economic issues? I think you made a very strong point to begin with that Iraq, Afghanistan, and our economic situation are tied very intimately as a result of our dependence on fossil fuels, particularly coming out of a very precarious part of the world. But does it make some sense maybe to look more regionally at this in terms of economic ties, not to supplement that from the global, obviously, effort, but could we potentially have more success on a regional basis rather than on the UN or global kind of approach to this?
Well, thank you for a thoughtful question, Senator Dodd. I do believe the treaty must be global in nature, and I think that the efficacy of a cap-and-trade system goes way up when it is truly global. It becomes much more efficient. It's not a bucket with a hole in it. It's actually a complete system. But in the introduction of renewable sources of electricity, it can make a lot of sense to look at regional tie-ups. I'll show you one quick example that was published in Nature magazine just a year and a half ago. that illustrates the proposed supergrid in Europe that links Northern Africa with Western Europe. Just as one of the arguments for helping Mexico's economy was that it's more effective to stem illegal immigration by creating more opportunities for jobs south of the border, one way to deal with the flows of immigration into Europe from Northern Africa and through Northern Africa that have generated unfortunate outbursts of xenophobia in Europe is to create more economic opportunity there. In the Sahara, the sun resource is astonishing. And those pink dots there represent concentrating solar thermal plants, the technology that I was talking with the chairman about, linked in a what they call a supergrid, similar to the unified national smart grid that President Obama has proposed for the United States. The yellow triangles are wind installations on the west coast of Africa. Spain, of course, and Germany are already the leading proponents and installers of solar and wind. And by linking Western Europe to Northern Africa, they can accomplish a shift to renewable electricity. There are other regional linkages in Asia, for example. In the western part of India and Rajasthan and the areas of desert where there is a similar, very impressive solar resource, there can be supplies of renewable electricity that supply the entire region. Similarly in China. China's already building a lot of solar plants. So this is just one illustration of how a regional approach can be an effective way to shift to renewable electricity.
Appreciate that very much. Any comment on the Brazilian effort here with the issue of the possibility of expanding into that Amazon River basin with further deforestation to produce more ethanol out of sugarcane is a worry, and apparently you're not as concerned about that.
No, I am. Thank you for giving. I didn't answer it, and I thank you for giving me another chance. I simply forgot. President Lula has recently proposed, on the eve of the Poznan negotiation last December, a truly impressive, large, short-term goal of avoiding the deforestation pattern that has been so prominent in the Amazon. What's been going on there is really very troubling, and with your permission, I'll show you a very quick example of it from the Western Amazon basis over a period of 25 years. President Lula's proposal is to stop thoughtless destruction of valuable areas of rainforest. And it's important to note that the exploitation of the sugarcane growing areas in Brazil, which gives a highly efficient source of ethanol that's efficient economically and in terms of energy balance, does not have to inevitably have the knock-on consequence of causing destruction in the Amazon. It's a different area of Brazil, and with the kind of policy innovation that President Lula has proposed, I believe that they can, if they enforce it. That's been one of the problems with past initiatives. If they enforce it, I think that they can continue to provide global leadership on ethanol production and avoid deforestation. Of course, everyone hopes, and Senator Lugar mentioned this, that we will soon be able to move quickly to the next generation cellulosic ethanol that won't compete with food crops and will give us better options.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Senator Dodd. Thank you for your generous comments. Appreciate it. Senator Corker.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and I want to join in welcoming you here. Tennessee has a legacy of having people here in the Senate and in public service that have been of major consequence and contributed in a major way to the public debate. And you, thank no you. Doubt, have built, helped build that legacy, and I hope thank in some small way to follow on. So I appreciate you being here, and I thank you for your presentation. And very much enjoyed your sense of humor, too, I might add. Thank you very much.
I benefit from low expectations.
You know, my goal in this debate is to make sure that as we move along this road to Copenhagen, that we also focus on things like energy security, and that we are transparent with the American people. And I think that actually is the very best way to build the political consensus that you are talking about today. And I really do. I appreciate your comments on the front end regarding our dependence on oil. I certainly appreciate the focus on deforestation. And my goal here today is actually to build more of a mutuality if we can. What I've seen, Jeff Bingham and I spent a week in Europe meeting with carbon traders and European Commission members and others, and I think what we've seen from the initial steps that have taken place there has been a lot of form over substance in many ways that we can learn from. And on one hand, some steps were taken, but with free allocations and offsets and all kinds of things, there really wasn't the transparency and purity there that I think would most be most beneficial. We're now firing with real bullets. I mean, I think the stars have lined up, and my sense is that this year something may really occur. And I hope to sort of be like BASF. They don't make the product, but they make the product better. And that's my goal in this debate, as I've mentioned. You've said some interesting things that I think actually could have the result of bringing people together. For instance, you have talked in the past about a carbon tax. Right. And the fact that if that is implemented, then it ought to be 100% returned to people through a payroll tax, which, by the way, I agree with and actually had an amendment on the floor this last year to that effect in some degree. Do you agree that if, at the end of the day, we're talking the bottom line result for on the road to Copenhagen for those who are on the roads in Carthage around your family farm is we're really talking about increasing the price of carbon, on oil, of natural gas, of ethanol, of all of those things. And I think you've talked about returning that increase in price to people, right, as I have. Should that same thing, let me just mention one other precursor. U.S. Cap was here last week. A lot of well-respected companies, CEOs that I've followed throughout my life, they made a presentation. And unlike or like most things that happen around here, the presentation centered on transference of wealth from our taxpayers, in most cases, to their companies, okay, or in some ways making their companies more competitive to others. So it was obviously put together to create a competitive advantage for them. I think we can build consensus around transparency. And if we were to have a cap and trade program, and I think candidly we will this year, is it your sense that revenues generated from that, like you had mentioned on carbon tax, should be returned to the American people?
Well, there have been a lot of people claiming part of those prospective revenues, and that will be for the Senate to determine. I think that Senator Lugar's advocacy of funds for adaptation to those unavoidable consequences already programmed into the climate system represents one destination for the global cap and trade system, not all of it by any means, but some portion of it. Yeah. I think that research into the new, more rapidly deployable renewable technologies is another. But I certainly believe that the simplest and easiest way to solve this problem would be a CO2 tax that is 100% refundable. The theoretical architect of President Reagan's economic plan, Arthur Laffer, who now lives in our home state, has publicly endorsed this, Billy Crystal, others. And that sometimes worries me, but I think that that would be the most direct way to do it. But a cap-and-trade system has they're not inconsistent, by the way. I think we need both. But a cap-and-trade system can be implemented globally. And I do think that in implementing a system here in the United States, we should do it in a way that pays very close attention to any economic impacts on the American people. And we should rapidly create the jobs in the building of the smart grid and efficiency and conservation measures and renewable energy and put people to work and make sure that, we get a net increase in jobs.
Well, look, I want to tell you that I wish we would just talk about a carbon tax, 100% of which would be returned to the American people, so there's no net dollars that would come out of the American people's pockets. And therefore, they're making a value decision about carbon. And those who use less benefit. Those who use more obviously do not benefit. But no money is taken out of our people's pockets. And actually, I hope that if we do a cap and trade program, we can implement those same elements. Let me talk to you. We talk about a global system. And obviously, the markets in each area, based on the amount of decreases in the economy and all of that, actually affect the carbon price. And we've seen carbon last year was at $40 a ton in Europe. Today it's much less. And obviously, you know, a good recession takes care of a lot of that, right? I mean, just because of energy output. But the fact is that allowances play a major role in distorting the markets. One of the things, if you talk to traders in Europe, they wish that they really would have auctioned 100% of the allowances.
Right.
We have companies here, and much of the public doesn't understand that these allowances are marketable securities. I mean, this is cash, that you can sell the very next day. Do you agree with me, and I think President Obama, that almost all of the allowances ought to be auctioned and not freely given out to companies, then in essence, again, is a huge transference of wealth.
Personally, I do agree with you, Senator Corker. Now, there are people who, for whom I have great respect, who've studied this for many years, who believe that a 100% auction will be very difficult to implement, and that a high percentage should be auctioned. I believe with you that it should be 100% auctioned, and I appreciate the time you've taken to learn about the European system. When they implemented their system, they calculated their base year in a very flawed way. But over the recent years, they have modified and changed their system to the point where it's much tighter and working much more effectively. The fact that they were operating within a global economy, most of which did not have cap and trade, made their challenge very difficult. And as I said earlier, if it's a truly global system, then you'll get the liquidity and the effectiveness that will really drive it toward higher levels of efficiency. But I think the best way to start is with an auction.
You know, we talk about the ways that we should lead. And I think a way that we might also lead is to actually set up a system that is transparent, that is pure, where the plumbing actually works, because, you know, I think we'd all have to say what's happened in Europe has met with mixed reviews because of all these distortions. One of those, again, being offsets. You know, we, as of November 1st, 2008, International Rivers has calculated that most of these offsets that are called clean development mechanisms that I think hugely distort the market. Most of the projects, three quarters of them, were already under construction and were going to happen anyway. And so the whole issue of additionality is a pretty big deal. I actually think, and I think we have to figure out a way to deal with deforestation in parts of the world. I really believe that. But I think that offsets are another one of those things that hugely distort the market, because instead of actually reducing carbon emissions, You're doing things that are highly questionable and actually outside the market that you're in. I'd love any comments you might have in that regard.
Yeah, well, another thoughtful question. I think there's a general agreement that in Copenhagen, significant reforms of the CDM as a collective development mechanism has to be implemented. And I think there's general acceptance of that idea. And there's been a lot of work on how to reform it and make sure that it's targeted on what it needs to be focused on instead of some of these peripheral areas. I agree with you.
And if I could just one last question, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the succinct responses. I agree with you that carbon capture and sequestration is a long ways off. My mind has a hard time understanding how on a commercial scale we're going to be doing it. One CEO that's highly involved in coal has said that when donkeys fly, okay, we will be dealing with that. I just have to ask, so as we look at that and we look at energy production in this country, nuclear, one would have to believe that as we deal with the issue of carbon, that nuclear would have to play a huge role in that. And I just wonder what comments you might have in that regard.
Well, first of all, just a brief comment on your statement about carbon capture. The one place that, well, one of the places that actually has sequestered carbon is in Norway, and it refers back to your earlier comment, because if you ask them the secret to it, they say, well, we imposed a CO2 tax, and we told the gas producers out in the North Sea that it has particularly high CO2 content, that if they could capture it and sequester it safely, then they wouldn't have to pay the tax. So they said, okay. And they went, and they've done it fairly successfully. Now, it's a unique set of conditions. There's a demonstration project in Algeria. It's not impossible. It's just implausible that it can be done on a widespread scale. Now, on nuclear, I used to represent Oak Ridge, as you do now, where my constituents were, in those years, immune to the impacts of radiation. So I was very enthusiastic about nuclear power. And I came to the Congress in 1976 as a very strong supporter of nuclear power. I have grown skeptical about the degree to which it will expand. I'm not opposed to it, but there is now in the industry absolutely zero ability to predict with any confidence what the cost of construction is. The nuclear waste storage problem will undoubtedly be solved, but there are other problems. They only come in one size, extra large. And when utilities have a limited construction budget and an uncertain demand projection, because with the price of oil going up and down and new conservation measures coming in, they fear we might face the kind of situation that we faced in the Tennessee Valley area in the 70s and 80s, where TVA started all these new nuclear plants on an assumption that there was going to be a 7% annual increase in electricity usage, and then the energy crisis dropped it down to 1%. So they canceled all those plants, and the ratepayers are still paying for the unbuilt plants. The utility executives become allergic to placing large bets on large increments with uncertain construction costs over a long period of time into the future. And that's why you've had, in last year, by far the largest new construction of electricity generation was with renewables. Coal has actually gone down, renewables have gone up, and nuclear has been at kind of a standstill. Now, I think there will be some new nuclear plants, but the proliferation consequences will limit its spread as a worldwide option. If it did expand dramatically, we would run out of fuel in a relatively short order, unless we went to reprocessing. And reprocessing makes it hugely more expensive and actually expands the quantity of high-level waste that has to be safely sequestered. That's counterintuitive. I used to think that reprocessing would cut down on the waste. It actually increases the amount of waste and the cost. So for all those reasons, I think that it'll play a small extra role. I don't think it's a silver bullet, and I don't think it'll play a large role.
Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you, and if I could just say one thing. I think this has been an excellent meeting. I hope that we in the Senate will, instead of concocting some Rube Goldberg mechanism that basically disguises what we're doing from the American public, we'll do exactly the kind of thing that Vice President Gore has advocated, and that is be transparent, be direct, let people fully understand what it is we're doing, return those monies to the American people, put a tax on carbon. And to me, I don't know why. I think the American people are intelligent. I think they get it if we just explain it to them. And, again, I want to thank you for bringing one of Tennessee's great public leaders here today, and thank you for having this hearing.
Well, thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you.
Let me just say to you that we're putting a working group together, which will include Senator Bingaman, Senator Boxer, Senator Lieberman, others, and we need it to be on a bipartisan basis. We need your involvement and others so that we piece this thing together differently from the way we did last year and try to solve a lot of those problems of the transparency and understanding of it up front and early. And our hope is to do that so that we can advance Copenhagen as well as our own efforts here in the country. So we need you to be part of that. Now, I might just point out to you, I'll just give you this, but we'll put it in the record that with respect to the future plants, last fall, there's a new solar power plant in California that began operating. It used to operate under old technology, but the new technology has empowered it to come back online. And the solar thermal factory for the mirrors is in Las Vegas. Over the next years, Alstra is the company that's doing it. They're going to build 2 gigawatts of solar power plants, generating 4,000 construction jobs, 1,000 operational jobs, and clean green power for over 300,000 American homes. I think that's what Vice President Gore is talking about, and a lot of us. I mean, that's the future. There's a Sempra generation put together the largest thin film solar power plant in North America. It's located in Nevada, analysts estimate that it can produce power for less than the cost of traditional electricity. So that's what's staring us in the face, if we will get the grant money and the incentive money and other efforts out there. You've been very patient. Thank you, Senator Feingold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and, of course, Vice President Gore. Thank you for coming before the committee to testify and for your longstanding leadership on this issue. It's been incredible. And as your testimony has made clear, climate change is a pressing issue for the United States, for our environment and economic stability, our energy security and independence, and ultimately our national security. We can't afford to continue dragging our feet on this issue. And you know of my involvement on Africa issues and chairing the Africa subcommittee. You've already referred to it several times. I'm concerned that the impacts of climate change will be the harshest on those countries least responsible for and least able to escape its effects. In many of these countries, rapid environmental changes are exacerbating droughts and intensifying famine, even contributing to conflict over scarce resources. Addressing the capabilities of the poorest countries to adapt to the impacts of climate change must be a central focus of the upcoming United Nations negotiations, and I would like to actually pursue your thoughts on some of that. Chairman, I'd like to put my full statement in the record, if I could.
Without objection.
Vice President, I'd like to hear your general thoughts on the importance of the United States participating in international negotiations on climate change. Specifically, what does it mean for global climate change efforts if the United States does not ratify a post-2012 agreement? To assist with U.S. ratification, do you think it's necessary to establish different obligations for highly emitting developing countries such as China and India, and then the more low-emitting countries such as those in Africa?
Well, Senator Feingold, thank you for your kind words and for your leadership on this issue. I guess all of us here are vulnerable to chauvinism and our pride in the United States of America, but that having been said, I do think it's objectively true that our country is the only country in the world that can really lead the global community. Some have speculated that sometime in the future, if European Union actually unifies to a much higher degree and has a president and an effective legislative body that has real power, they might somehow emerge as with potential for global leadership. I'm not going to hold my breath, and I don't know of any other contender that's even on the scene. And again, I don't want to be too proud, to be just sort of chest beating about that. But I just think that the United States is the only nation that can lead the world. And this is the most serious challenge the world has ever faced, alongside the potential for some nuclear exchange, which is a possibility that thankfully has been receding over the last couple of decades. This is the one challenge that could completely end human civilization. And it is rushing at us with such speed and force, it's completely unprecedented. And as one strategic analyst in the Pentagon wrote in a landmark study of why Pearl Harbor wasn't prevented, he said, we as human beings have a tendency to confuse the unprecedented with the improbable. If something's never happened before, we tend to think, well, that's not going to happen. The problem is the exceptions can kill you. and this is one of them. And if the world's going to respond, the United States has to lead the world. And that's one of many reasons why I'm so grateful for President Obama's bipartisan outreach and bold leadership to say the United States has to lead on this issue.
Meaning that we would need to ratify a post.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And what about the distinction between highly emitting developing countries such as China and India versus low emitting countries, creating different obligations? Is that something you think would be appropriate?
Well, you know, the binary categories of developed and developing were established before the Treaty of Rio de Janeiro in 1992 at the so-called Earth Summit. Senator Kerry and I were there, and I believe some others on this committee were. President Bush, President George H.W. Bush signed that. The Senate ratified it. We are legally obligated under that treaty, by the way, to keep the world below, to keep emissions below dangerous levels. And since that time, the scientific community has fleshed out with abundant clarity what that means. We are already above dangerous levels. So we have a legal obligation under that treaty to do it. But when those categories were established, China wasn't what it is today. In an ideal world, we would change those categories. And we would not have just A and B. We would have different categories. But trying to get that done at the same time when we're negotiating one of the most complex treaties the world has ever attempted, I fear it is almost certainly impossible, because those who feel that their equities are damaged by being transferred from one category to another are gonna fight the change, and there are enough of them that it would be very difficult. I think that the more effective way to do it, Senator Feingold, is to modify the obligations that are expected of those in Category A and Category B, and you can have some gradations in those expectations to take
as
into account
to
individual
categories.
Nations. Correct.
Okay.
I'd prefer to change the categories. I just don't think it's doable.
Let me quickly go to another subject. I already said a little bit about it. According to a study by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change entitled Impacts, Adaptation, Vulnerability, Africa is one of the most vulnerable continents to climate change and climate variability. And the report goes on to note that the continent has already started to experience the impacts of climate change in a manner disproportionate to its emission contribution. So looking forward to these negotiations again, what steps need to be taken to ensure that the needs and voices of poor developing nations, including those in Africa, are fairly represented, and what role, specific role, does the United States have in helping to achieve this?
Well, I agree with comments earlier from Senator Lugar that a large and adequate adaptation fund should be a part of this treaty to help areas like Africa that are already beginning to experience the harshest impacts. 13 countries in Africa experienced all-time record flooding just a year and a half ago, and some of them are still recovering. Epicenter was Ghana. We're seeing really very difficult drought conditions in many of it, linked to these long-term climate, the rapidly emerging climate trends. But the other side of that coin, Senator Feingold, is that the solutions to the climate crisis are in many cases more easily and readily deployable in regions like Africa than they are in developed countries. Just as these nations leapfrogged the old fixed-line telephone service and went straight to cell service, they can leapfrog the old central generating station electricity and go straight to widely distributed solar and wind. You're seeing a massive introduction of solar electric panels in Kenya, for example, and in many other countries. The reforestation programs that will be a part of the solution in Copenhagen can provide large numbers of new jobs for employment programs in Africa. Wangari Maathai has demonstrated this already with her Greenbelt program. So the solutions to the climate crisis can flip this around and accelerate the entrance of Africa into the world economy to lift standards of living there.
Thank you so much, Mr. Vice President.
Thank you very much, Senator Feingold. Senator Isaacson.
Mr. Vice President, it's a pleasure. I find your presentations always very informative, and I don't think I've missed a one since you've been here. And I'm going to take advantage of your being here now. I'd like, Bertie, would you do me a favor? Would you make sure the Vice President gets this? I want to commend you on the talk about open space and green space and reforestation. For 10 years, I have promoted a piece of legislation called America's Open Space Environmental Infrastructure Act, which deals with creating conservation easements to protect natural resources, rivers, streams, things of that nature, open space, green space, and forest, where an individual can still have the quiet enjoyment of their land and the government can be insured of the protection for migratory habitat, for carbon production, which Mother Nature does it best by sequestering it, and we both know that. So I hope you'll take it and read it. I would, and I have no pride of authorship. If you want to take it and promote it, you're welcome to do so, because I think it is a key component in what we're talking about here today. Secondly, I want to return to nuclear. Senator Corker brought it up, and you and I have engaged on this before.
Mm-hmm.
Couple things. From 2000 to 2006, the leading country in the world in carbon reduction was France, 6%. United States, 3%.
On the floor.
The primary difference that I can see is that they generate almost all of their electric energy from nuclear. A couple things you said I want to just talk about for a second. One is, I had always understood, and I stand to be corrected, and I defer to your position. You're probably right, and I'm probably wrong, but I'd always been led to believe that the reprocessing of nuclear spent fuels for a second use reduced by 90% the storage problem. And you said it was a greater storage problem. So I'm not questioning you. I'm questioning myself, but that's what I've been told.
Well, that was my impression also, Senator Isaacson, until fairly recently. And it is my understanding that the volume of waste that has to be stored safely actually does increase with reprocessing. The industry has even called it recycling. And it does give the impression that it cuts down on the volume. But the information that I believe is correct, and I, like you, am always open to being corrected on these things, but I believe it actually increases the amount of waste.
Yeah, I don't know if it's appropriate to ask a vice president to do this, but if you could ask some of your staff research and get that answer to me, I'd really like to know.
If it's permitted to supplement my response for the record, I'll be happy to do
that. Oh, absolutely. We'll leave
anytime we can get facts right, I'm always, because we're as politicians, we sometimes run off with a bad idea.
Better than the alternative.
Yeah. Well, we'll get the committee staff also.
Thank you very much. Secondly, now this I think I am right about, because I went through it in the 1970s and in the state legislature, the Whoops bonds collapsed in Washington State. They stopped building the nuclear plants. TVA had their difficulty. But I don't think it's a correct assumption that they made a misassumption on the growth of demand. What in fact happened was that the formation of capital and the cost of servicing it went so great, the cost of the plants went through the roof. Washington State Public Power was paying 15.75% tax-free on those bonds, because that's what happened to that marketplace at that time. Which brings me to a suggestion. I am an advocate of nuclear. I do not think if you accept every dire circumstance of climate change, and I'm not saying I don't, I'm just saying if you accept every dire circumstance and you take a clean, reliable source of energy that we know works off the table, or you make it so difficult to do it that you can't do it, I don't think you can ever get to the solution you're seeking. But I will tell you this, construction work while in progress is a mechanism of financing a power plant by putting it in the rate base and paying cash as you go for a significant part of it that removes the debt service interest component from the cost of a plant and gives you a reliable way to deal with the cost of building those plants. So one of the problems we've had in this country from a standpoint of nuclear since the 1970s was, one, the adverse reaction to Three Mile Island. First of all, I recognize that. Second of all was the cost that blew through the roof in the 1970s, which you mentioned. But Bob is a much better businessman than I am, but there are a lot of ways to skin a cat. And if we have the dire circumstances we're facing, we need to find every way to skin every cat. And I think creative mechanisms of financing and a more open mindset on our part to using safe, reliable, renewable nuclear energy makes a lot of sense. I apologize for making a little speech there.
No, I also have appreciated the exchanges that we have had, and as a prelude to providing information for the record, one of the experts on this reprocessing issue is Allison McFarlane at George Mason University, who is one of the sources of my information that reprocessing increases the overall volume of the waste. But I'll provide her study for the record and any other relevant information.
Thank
you. On your comment about what happened to TVA in the 70s, I think both things are true. No doubt the construction costs went through the roof. In the fall of 73, the Arab OPEC oil embargo shot energy prices up, and coal shouldn't be tied to oil, you would think, but it is, and coal prices went up, electricity prices went up, and so conservation kicked in, and the cost of construction, as you said, went very high. But it's also true that when they launched their massive program of 21 new reactors, they were projecting a 7% annual increase in electricity demand, and it fell rapidly to 1% per year. And they talked about the decoupling. It used to be one-for-one increases in energy use and economic output, and that was decoupled during that period in the 70s. I don't take nuclear off the table. I'm not a reflexive opponent of nuclear. I just don't see any at-risk private dollars going into it because they, you know, France, Areva, their big company there, it's 92% owned by the French government, and 95% of its output goes to the French government. So, again, the private at-risk dollars, that's what is one indicator of whether the market is really betting on this or not. If it does, fine. We need to solve these problems, but I just don't think it's going to play that much of a bigger role.
Well, I appreciate the response, and I know I don't have any more time. Just respond a little bit on that. What the parameters that the government allows vis-a-vis finance has a lot of difference in whether private capital will chase that type of investment or not. And the lack of belief right now by most private investment that nuclear will be sanctioned by this country in any form or would not be subject to a reaction keeps those dollars from following it. So it's in our interest, both from a financing mechanism as well as from the regulatory side, to develop some level of confidence. The cost of that capital will go down and the formation will expand. But again, thank you very much for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Isaacson. Senator Cardin.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much, Vice President Gore. It's really a pleasure to have you here, and I thank you on behalf of people of Maryland, but more importantly, people of the world, for your extraordinary leadership in bringing this issue to the attention so that politically we can get something done. We all know there's a problem, but to get the political will has been difficult, and I think you've made a giant progress for us, so we thank you for that. Last year's bill, the United States must exercise leadership. There's no question about that. The bill we had last year that started to move through committee, it accomplished a specific goal on carbon emission reductions, and it put the United States in the leadership internationally on dealing with global climate change, and it provided the tools in order to accomplish it. And I agree with the chairman and other comments that have been made. We have to put together a broader coalition, and we're going to have to look for modifications to last year's bill. But I thought it was the right message, and I hope a bill at least as strong will move through this Congress and be signed by President Obama. I want to mention one issue that's been mentioned about whether the United States can lead without other countries joining us from the onset.
Mm-hmm.
What do we do about India and China? If the United States adopts strict standards, does that put our manufacturers at a disadvantage or put our economy at a disadvantage? I want to tell you up front, I believe that we should lead and we should pass legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And we shouldn't make a precondition that China or India or any other country agrees to the standards. But I do think we need to be able to have an international regime that recognizes the responsibility of every nation to reduce carbon emissions. One vehicle could be the World Trade Organization and looking for a legitimate way to put a price on products that enter the international marketplace that have not met acceptable international standards on carbon reduction. Perhaps there are other ways to achieve those goals. But it seems to me that the United States needs to exercise international leadership beyond just the specific bills or treaties that deal with carbon reductions and the global climate change issue, but also making sure that the international community carries out its responsibility. And I will welcome your thoughts as to whether you believe this is realistic or how we should go about making sure that other countries indeed follow our leadership, assuming we get the job done.
Well, thank you, Senator Cardin, and thank you for your leadership. One of the differences between today and 2007, when Kyoto was negotiated, is that there is now a widespread acceptance in the developing countries that they have to have differentiated but binding commitments in the first phases of a treaty. And back 11 years ago, they were nowhere close to being willing to join in the first phase. They were willing to be brought in the second phase, but now they are, and some of them have taken leadership on their own. And I think it'll make our task in this country of getting support for a treaty much easier.
Do you think it's realistic that we could use an organization such as the WTO to enforce obligations if other countries do not? I mean, our bill last year provided for a trade remedy. It had a significant enough time frame so that we could get international action before any penalties took place. But it's also probably problematic right now whether that would be permitted under the WTO.
That is correct, Senator. And one of the most interesting frontiers in international law is the intersection of the solution to the climate crisis and the world trading system. If the WTO could be modified to allow the inclusion of a carbon avoidance component at the border, I personally would enthusiastically endorse that. If it cannot be negotiated as part of the WTO, then it becomes very difficult for countries to do it on their own. But I would add one other point, and Senator Kerry and I were talking about this this morning at breakfast, and Senator Lugar and I were talking about soil carbon earlier. The Doha round broke down mainly on the issue of agriculture and the different viewpoints toward agriculture from developed and developing nations. If we had soil carbon sequestered in a way that allowed credits for soil carbon and a modification of WTO provisions, this could fill the gap that could restart the Doha round and integrate the solutions to the climate crisis with forward progress on a fair and reciprocal trading system reform.
I thank you for those comments. Let me just mention one additional issue. We've all talked about making decisions based upon science, and you've mentioned that many times, and I agree with you. The difficulty is that there is different views as to the scientific information. I think the conclusion is pretty obvious. I would just hope that as we look for our legislation here in the United States, but also international treaties, that there be some support for uniform scientific information so that we all are operating with the same set of facts and what we're trying to achieve. And I would just like to get that on the radar screen as you're our ambassador on this issue.
Well, thank you, Senator Cardin, and I would like to associate myself with the remarks Senator Lugar made in his opening statement about a reaffirmation of the importance of science in policymaking, and I share his commendation of Dr. Jane Lubchenco and Dr. John Holdren and Dr. Stephen Chu, all of whom have now been appointed and confirmed to important policymaking positions and are outstanding international leaders in science. I couldn't agree with you more.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, if I will, I'll put the rest of my comments in the record if that would be permitted.
And I thank the Senator. The Chairman has asked me to recognize now Senator Riff.
Thank you very much. Mr. Vice President, very briefly, because we all have to go vote. Thank you. I did. Mr. Vice President, you've obviously studied this and produced a lot of information for us today. And what does your modeling tell us we will do as a species if we don't do what you're suggesting, or if America does what you're suggesting but other countries don't follow? We've been around a couple hundred thousand years. expanded over the last 60,000 years only. What does your modeling tell you about how long we're going to be around as a species?
Well, I don't claim the expertise to answer a question like that, Senator, but there are some distinguished scientists who have expressed grave concern that along with all of the catastrophes that they've predicted over the nearer term, if we don't rein in these emissions, we could cross a point of no return beyond which the damage could be irretrievable and would grow worse. Professor Jim Hansen, in his most recent paper, wrote about the Venus syndrome, which basically means that if we set off catastrophic warming, it could become unstoppable. Just 2 days ago, Professor Susan Solomon at NOAA produced an important study about how these large-scale changes could become irreversible. Indeed, some of the, not the most serious ones, but some have already become irreversible. The worst can still be avoided. Professor James Lovelock, the originator, co-originator of the Gaia hypothesis, has perhaps the darkest view that human civilization would be almost completely disrupted if we don't deal with this challenge. And these kinds of apocalyptic predictions can, unfortunately, paralyze action because people just hear that and they think, oh, well, you know, there's no hope anymore. But the scientists tell us that if we act boldly and in the near term, we can avoid the worst consequences. And I choose to put the emphasis on that part of it.
And what you said, they predict what will happen if we do act. Has anybody predicted what will happen if we don't, if we just stay on the course that we're on? Has anybody predicted how long we're going to be around?
I don't know that anybody has predicted how long the human species would survive if we don't act. I think the scenario that those scientists warn us about is not for any, you know, extinction of the human species, but rather of the risk of the collapse of the basis for civilization as we know it. For example, a sea level rise that produced hundreds of millions of climate refugees would certainly destabilize countries around the world. We've already seen what the influx of refugees from Chad into the Darfur region of Sudan has done in complicating the tensions and violence there. Are other causes, but the head of the UN says that's one of the principal causes. We've seen climate refugees in other parts of the world. We have seen also the migration of tropical diseases into temperate zones where we don't have the immunities and habituation to those diseases and grave risks from that. The number of threats that are cataloged by these scientists it's a really daunting list. So prudence alone would dictate that we take action to avoid them.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Well,
thank you very much, Senator. Vice President Gore, the chair will call for a temporary recess pending the return of the chairman. He is voting, as you know.
I'm familiar with the exercise, Senator. Thank you. I'll be here when y'all get back.
Ask for your patience and that of those who are witnessing the hearing.
Thank you. Thank you.
As you can hear, the committee has taken a break. You can hear the rest of the testimony, about another 37 minutes, by downloading the file from ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. Look on the Climate Solutions page of our audio on-demand menu. You can also find Al Gore's full testimony there as well.